It's quite challenging, isn't it, to follow a God that you cannot see. That's one of the greatest challenges in faith. Have you ever tried to explain God to a friend and you'll realize just how hard it is to put this unseen God into words? St. Augustine used to tell a story about how difficult it was to describe the Trinity, and he used this picture of a little child on a beach with a bucket, running to the ocean to fill up the bucket of water, then running back to the hole that he had dug and pouring the water into the hole. But the moment he poured the water into the hole, he realized the water just seeped away. And so he'd run back to the waves again and fill up the bucket and run back to the hole and keep pouring it in. And maybe your children have done this exercise, but the hole never gets filled. And the sea never gets emptied. Every time we try and fit God into our hole of comprehension, we realize that it'll never get filled. It can be so hard to follow a God you cannot see. And so I imagine it was even harder to follow this star towards the new king. If you've ever watched the stars move, it's just so slow, isn't it? It requires patience. It would be hard to trust that this particular star was going to lead them to the newborn king. And so you can understand why many people in life, rather than do this slow, hard work of discovery and exploration, well, we like to put God into one place and fix God there, so that God becomes this static companion, this fixed idea, so that we know exactly where we've left God, so that we can pick up the conversation again. A God who really doesn't interfere with our lives. After all, we're all busy, aren't we? We don't need a God to interfere. Our weekly schedules are packed full of trying to coordinate our schedules, our families, our lives. It doesn't leave much room for meditating on the incomprehensibility of God. So we fix God into one place. There's a phrase I was remembering this week as we spent New Year's Eve with our new American friends here in BES. A little Swahili word slipped out, haraka, and it reminded me of a phrase that was said often when we lived in Kenya. And my Swahili friends, you can finish it for me. It goes like this: haraka, haraka, hakuna, baraka. Haraka, haraka, hakuna, baraka. It's a beautiful phrase. Haraka means hurry. If you want someone to hurry, you go haraka, 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 haraka. Baraka means blessing. And what it's saying here is if you haraka, haraka, then you have no blessing in life. When you hurry, you're not going to experience blessing. I think that phrase tells us so much about a certain culture, that it's important to take time to build relationships. You can't do this in a hurry. If you haraka your relationships, there'll be no blessing in it, and you won't be transformed by the relationships. But in the West, we take priority over tasks and events and the programs, don't we? I was trying to think in the West, do we have an equivalent to that phrase, haraka, haraka, hakuna, baraka? And the closest I got was the more hurry, more haste, less speed. But that doesn't quite match up. Sure, it doesn't. Because the more you're in haste, the less you're speedy with it. And we still like the idea of being speedy, being efficient, with our lives. And it's nothing to do with that sense of relationships. And when I think about this haraka life, this hurried life, it means our lives have become so busy sometimes and so important here, we don't have the time to let God disrupt us. We don't have the time to let God take us on this slow journey of transformation, where we're open to being changed by the good news. And in this story of Matthew 2, you see two groups of people who were in this haraka business, the hurried business, who had a very fixed idea of God over here, but their lives were continuing on over there. The first group of people was King Herod himself. The Magi go and meet this king and say to him, the question, where is this new king? Where is he who's born king of the Jews? And Herod does all the right things. He calls in the experts, the scholars, the teachers of the law, and the information Herod gathers is really accurate. This prophecy from Micah that the new ruler's not going to be born in Jerusalem, he's going to be born in Bethlehem. But here's the interesting thing. Herod does not leave his hurried life to go and encounter the king. He stays in the empire that he's been building. Because you see, Herod was this odd sort of a man, an odd mixture. Ken Bailey describes him as racially Arab, religiously Jewish, culturally Greek, and politically Roman. And you can see how mixed up his identity was. That would have made me paranoid. Who am I? Why am I here? He wasn't coming from this pure line of descent to the throne. And so to prove his worth in the kingdom, Herod was very speedy at his building projects. Eugene Peterson, in his book, The Jesus Way, says, look around Jerusalem, and you see the success of Herod in the art, in the architecture, in literary works, in dramatic productions, in athletic prowess, in performance. He built the amphitheaters, the hippodromes, the palaces, the shrines, the roads, the restored cities, the fountains. He even rebuilt the temple, Jerusalem. Herod was busy. He was so busy. And rather than go and meet the newborn king, Herod kept up this busyness. He didn't want to risk being found out that he was the imposter in the empire. He didn't want to risk losing everything. Now, just before you detach yourself from Herod, we do that, don't we? If we just work hard to try and prove that we belong here, then everything will be all right. Hopefully no one will find out that deep inner fear that we don't really fit in. As long as you keep busy in this way, then you'll be like the Herod. There'll be no joy and no blessing. You need the different way. Haraka, haraka, hakuna, baraka. There was another group of people in Jerusalem who had a very fixed, detached view of God too, and that was the chief priests and the scribes. They were in Jerusalem, this holy city. We've just read from Isaiah 60 about the holy city, arise, shine, and the light will come. Kings will come to the brightness of your dawn. These teachers knew not just the story of Jerusalem, but they knew the story of the Messiah from Micah chapter 5, that this newborn Jesus was going to be born in Bethlehem. But the ones who knew the most about God were the ones who were the least interested in encountering him. We don't need to search for Jesus. We know exactly where he is, over there, in Bethlehem. And with all this right doctrine, they were keeping a good professional distance. Did they think that because they were living in Jerusalem, everything would work out all right? They knew that the holy city was the place where heaven was going to meet earth again, the new heavens, the new earth. Were they so caught up in their religion that doing things was more important than being with God? We don't know. But like Herod, they were busy and they missed out on the blessing. Haraka, haraka, hakuna, baraka. N.T. Wright says, isn't it so striking to see the contrast between the outsiders who were hungry spiritually and the insiders who possessed the scriptures and yet failed to recognize that this kingdom was coming in and it was going to reverse everything. These were the people who could have prevented that dreadful slaughter of the innocents. They had a responsibility. But they did just enough to know the truth, just enough with their Bibles to know, oh, we'll probably be all right. But they didn't encounter the Word made flesh. Those two groups of people were so hurried and harried with their life, the blessing of God was somewhere else. But we come to a final group of people, these magi, who had a deep longing to search for this God. Mark Powell talks about how these magi were most likely the servants of kings, and in those days, kings were often tyrannical and corrupt. It's possible these magi were victims of abuses of power. And so they had a longing for a king who was going to be different, a leader who was going to rule in a different way. It's hard to imagine, isn't it, following a king from a different country. Imagine going out on a journey to do that. You only do that if you're not happy with the system you're in. And it would have been risky, too, to swap your loyalties to this newborn king. Were they hoping for a different kingdom? Were they hoping for a new kind of politics? A new way where the broken and the humble would get lifted up and restored? Regardless of the reason, these magi took on this long, slow search for the newborn king. And what happens is that the star slowly draws them into this new vision of the kingdom. First to Jerusalem, and then God's word confirms that natural revelation of the star and brings them to Bethlehem, the true fulfillment of Isaiah 60, a vision that's inclusive, a vision that says all nations are going to come and gather round, not Jerusalem, but around the child, because Jesus is the reconciler of all peoples and all nations. And you know, any time astrologers are mentioned in the Bible, they get really bad press. Think of Simon the sorcerer in Acts. They're always treated with suspicion, but God is showing us something here, that his grace is big. God can cope with a wide mercy that welcomes pagan astrologers in. God is showing the extent of his grace, that in the same way when he used Balaam, who was a pagan magician, to predict that a star is going to rise out of Jacob, now he can use these magi, these pagan astrologers, to show that Christ's rising star is the light to draw all people in. And the question, I imagine, for the magi was whether they thought this was going to be enough, whether this long, unhurried journey was going to bring them the blessing that they wanted. Last weekend, our family took a road trip. We got in the car and we journeyed over the state border to Ohio, to Toledo Zoo. And for any of you who have been on those kind of road trip journeys with your families, maybe you've just come back from one of them. There's many episodes in that feature film called The Road Trip, isn't there? There's the "Are we there yet?" that happens right at the start. And then when they realize we're not there yet, then the "I'm hungry" episode. There's many episodes to that. Then there's many episodes to do with reconciliation in the backseat. And then somewhere along the way, there's that episode called doubt. Is this really worth it? Will we turn back and just go back home? There's the moment where you have to work through, is this really worth the journey? But we pressed on, we arrived at Toledo Zoo, and we saw that amazing light show late at night where there were lights everywhere, and it was fantastic. And it was worth the journey. The lights revived us and helped bring us together again. And I'm sure the Magi went through all these episodes too on this slow, painful journey. Is this really worth it? I'm not sure I'm on track. The pain, the doubt, the separation, the hunger, the tiredness, the despair. But when they see the Christ child, it says they're overflowing with joy. They know they've encountered the real thing. And they pour their gifts out to this newborn king. Sometimes when we fix God in a place, we want God to give us the gifts, don't we? Lord, keep me healthy. Help me have a good year in 2020. You want God to answer certain prayers. And when God doesn't give us the gifts that we want, then our view of God gets even more fixed and even more distant. But when we encounter the living God, the Christ child, we become full of his love and full of his joy, that we're the ones who are pouring out gifts back to him. And when you're that open and full of gratitude, you become changed. The Magi begin to dream dreams that God plants in their subconscious to return home by another way. Start following my way, not the way that's the old way, but follow me. There's a painting I was looking at this week by Leonardo da Vinci, one of his very earliest paintings on the journey of the Magi. It's not finished, but it's a fascinating, busy picture. There's a lot going on. The world is very chaotic. There's ruins, old Greek ruins. There's staircases that aren't complete. And it seems like the world in the background is in decay, and there's maybe a battleground happening, horses, military horses in the background. And in the foreground, you have the three tired, old, weary men who are presenting their gifts. And what's interesting to me is the Christ child is putting out his hand. This little child is reaching out to receive. Some people think it's the gift of myrrh. And it's almost as if this tiny child knows to embrace this myrrh, which will eventually embalm his own body as he dies in answer to the world's problems. And in this one picture, you have the full idea of what it is for the God to come down in love, to show us what true love really looks like, even before we know it for ourselves, that we need the cross, we need the journey to the cross and to the resurrection. This picture makes no sense, without those things, because Jesus came to reach out in love and accept that calling, accept that plan of salvation. We started talking about how hard it is, isn't it, to follow a God you can't see. And our reaction to that often is to fix God in one place, fix the idea. And there's a word for that in the Bible. It's called crucifixion, where we pin God on the cross. Crucifixion is our attempt to put God in a place that we can see with nails in him, so that he doesn't interfere. But that's not the God we serve. The cross is empty. Jesus is not on the cross. He's on the move. He's dynamic. He rose again. He's healing nations. He's drawing the most unlikely people to himself. That's the God we serve in love. The writer of The Cloud of Unknowing said this: "It's true, God cannot be comprehended by our intellect, but it's only our intellect is he incomprehensible. He's not incomprehensible to our love." I love that God reveals himself through his love and what he did on the cross and in the resurrection. David Adams said, "Too many have tried to fix the beloved rather than risk the adventure of courting him and being courted by him. If we journey with the beloved, we have a new heart for our travels, and like Moses, to be able to say, 'If you do not go with us, we will not go.'" And so in thinking about this Leonardo da Vinci painting, if you're unsure about whether it's worth in 2020 following this God and making all this effort, look around like Da Vinci did at the world around you. Look around at what's broken. Look at the political leaders, not just here in America, but in Europe, in Africa, in Asia. Look at the places where there's injustice. And we need this God to come in. We need this God to show us the way. We can't say haraka, haraka, hakuna, baraka. So the challenge today is, where do you find your place in this story? Are you like Herod? Not sure if you fit in, and so you'll keep building your projects. Or are you like the chief priests, consumed with getting the right answer? You're actually missing out on the encounter. Maybe we need that new heart of love for our travels. For some of you, the challenge is to be like the Magi and leave this place changed, to realize we're not part of the old dispensation now. We belong to this new kingdom. T.S. Eliot, in his poem, The Journey of the Magi, captures that when the Magi said at the end, "We return to our places, our kingdoms, but no longer at ease in these old dispensations." They had a restlessness that the world was broken, and they needed to keep focusing on this new kingdom. Someone who's done that recently is an organization called the Council of World Mission. It was formerly known as the London Missionary Society, the society that sent David Livingstone out to Africa. It began in 1795 when slavery was still legal in the British Empire. But in their New Year message that they just put out, they agreed to put out this public apology for the old dispensation, for the slave trade. And they announced plans to release some of their resources to a minimum of £10 million as reparation for their part in the legacy of slavery. They say, "We want to be ready in the future, this transformed future we imagine, and that means letting go of the old dispensation, confessing our part in the sin of racism that has been part of our past. For you and for me, we might not have the same massive responsibility, but our challenge is to be on the move with God and to be restless in the old dispensation. To say, like Moses in the desert, if you're not going to go with me, God, then I'm not going at all. And between each thought that we have and each action that we do, to say, Lord, are you in this? Are you present in this? That's what makes the difference. The alternative is haraka, haraka, hakuna, baraka. So let's determine in this new year to move towards this encounter with God, because only he meets that deep, deep longing. Only he can fill that place. So follow the star to the child and find that fullness, that overflowing joy there. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.